I led a retreat up in the Canadian Rockies this past weekend with the Wild Rose Sangha, the Sangha that Tracy started in Calgary. And they have a really wonderful way of dedicating the merit at the end of the evening. And I'd like to introduce it and to our Sangha and for us to just try it on for a while and see if we like it and see if we'd like to adopt it or not. It's very similar to what we've done, but just a little bit different. The person who's either the bellmaster or the person leading sutras says, dedication of merit, and then everyone joins in. May the merit of this practice benefit all beings and bring peace. Three times. Dedication of merit, and everyone joins in. May the merits of this practice benefit all beings and bring peace. Dedication of merit. May the merits of this practice benefit all beings and bring peace. The person who's leading that says, we especially dedicate our practice to, and then people, much as we have spoken people's names, people speak names of who they're dedicating their practice to, but it's done really quietly, so it's like a rustle of leaves through the whole community, and there'll be a sort of a here, da, 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 and everybody speaks who they're dedicating their practice to, and maybe more than one person. So there's just this flutter through the room over and over again. It's deeply moving. Mm-hmm. It brings all of our loved ones here with us. All the people who we support and who support us come into this room together. So maybe tonight we can dedicate our practice in that way, and we can try it on for a month or so and then decide if we want to continue in this way or not. And tonight we especially are dedicating our practice to Eileen Gurney, Fred's mother, who died recently and leave suddenly, so Fred's not here tonight with us, but we are there with him and with his family. I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about where how our practice was developed, where it came from. Yeah, our teacher, Thich Nhat Hanh, was raised and inspired to become a monk because of the war in his country, the continual war of many people, different nationalities running over Vietnam. And when the Americans when we got involved in the war and escalated the war, he spent a long time looking at you know, what were the roots of the war and how to address that, and realized that he needed to come talk to us as a nation, as a peoples, because if we really knew what was going on, we would stop the war. And so he came here to this country. You can imagine, you know, a humble monk who's about 5'3" coming to this country to tell us what was happening in his country as a result of the actions of our government, our military. And when he, this was in 1966, and after he had spoken with both the government and also many leaders, spiritual leaders, Martin Luther King, Thomas Merton, in our country, and was ready to go back to Vietnam, he wasn't allowed to return. He was considered by the communists as a traitor, and by the American people as a representative of the communist government, because he was speaking for peace, because he was speaking the middle way between these two opposing factions. And so he went to Paris and made an effort to join in the Paris peace talks, but again, because he wasn't representing any government, wasn't allowed to participate in the peace talks, Paris peace talks. And as he continued in the West, what he was trying to do kept being thwarted. After the war ended in 1975 and many people were fleeing Vietnam in tiny little boats, overloaded with people, and many were being drowned and killed by pirates. He got together two big ships to go out to the South China Sea to pick up boat people to save them. But everywhere he went to land, he was turned away. So all throughout Asia. He spoke once, he told a story about, I'm not sure what country he was in, one of the countries in Asia, Southeast Asia, where they had come to rest for one night, and the authorities came in the middle of the night and pounded on his door and said, you know, we're taking away your passport unless you leave tomorrow. You will become a non-person, a person without any place to go. And he said he practiced walking meditation all night, you know, not knowing what to do, not knowing what way to turn, and just touching the earth. And he realized that the next morning he had to go to the authorities and say, we're leaving. Even though there was no place to go, even though there was no country that would accept these two boats filled with refugees. And finally, Australia allowed them to land, and there's a wonderful Vietnamese community now in Australia. But, you know, so for like 15 years, everything he tried to do out of the compassion of his heart was thwarted. And he settled south of Paris in a small home he called Sweet Potato Village. And with all the confusion and depression and helplessness and hopelessness, began a garden. Began putting his hands in the earth, and knew that if he thought about what had happened, he would be overwhelmed with sorrow and suffering. And so he just took one seed at a time and put it into the earth that he tilled with his own hands, and took care of those seeds. And when they sprouted, he talked about thinning them, you know, just no matter what came to mind, he just came back to just pulling this one little seedling out so that the other ones could thrive. not letting anything distract him from just this simple act of thinning the lettuce. And whenever the overwhelm of the last 15 years came up, he'd simply come back to touching the earth and just tending the garden. And out of that practice of devoted and concentrated mindfulness, he saw something beneath the suffering, something that held the suffering, but also held joy. Something about the miracle of being alive as a human being. And out of that he started teaching, and he came to the United States to teach mindfulness, to teach the American people how to be completely present and how healing and transformation comes from that. And out of that healing and transformation, our touching, our deep touching of our true roots in the world, the true blessedness that holds us all. And when he, as he went from center to center, it was the first time I had met him on that when he was on that teaching tour, and he was going from Zen center to Zen center, teaching mindfulness. And he saw that though we had a practice of concentration and sitting meditation, when people got up off their cushions, there wasn't much connection between people. There was a lot of silence, and yet he didn't see a healthy sangha. And so he started talking about the importance of sangha. Importance of sangha, but the importance of living together harmoniously. The sangha is a community that lives in harmony and awareness. And that was continues to be one of the most important parts of our practice. And certainly from the time of the Buddha, having a sangha has been considered a very essential part of our practice. When we enter the path of practice, we vow to take refuge in the Buddha, our own ability to awaken, the awakened nature of the universe, in the Dharma, the teachings that show us the way to understand each other and be connected through true love, and the Sangha. Those are considered the three gems of our practice, and have been considered the three gems since the time of the Buddha, for 2,600 years ago. And you know, somehow, you know, in the early days of Zen in the United States, we got the idea of it was all about awakening. You know, there was a lot of emphasis on the Buddha and the Dharma. But a lot of sanghas didn't get along very well. And And so somehow the community was being left out. And, you know, in our tradition, it is very much a Sangha-based practice. It is very much a practice based in community. And I think here in Seattle, I think our community is pretty strong and feels pretty supported by and large. You know, we feel really supportive of each other. And there are communities practicing in our tradition, numerous as the sands of the Ganges, I'd say. I think many of us will be going on retreat with Thay in this teaching tour this summer, and we'll get a little taste of the really tens of thousands of people who are walking this path together. And so even though we come together on Monday nights and sit together and, you know, feel the joy of our community, we are also much, much bigger. Our community body is so much bigger than our practice here in Seattle. When we practice in this tradition, when we've taken Thay as our teacher, we wear a brown jacket, a brown robe. The brown robe is a symbol of the earth. And the humility and simplicity of the earth. And of the people who work the earth, of the peasants in the world. And we wear the brown jacket so to remember that, that we are part of the earth and we are part of the most simple peoples of the earth. We are part of the whole family of humanity. And, I mean, truly, each and every one of us is of the earth. And sometimes when I stay here overnight in the center, I'll get up in the morning and I'll walk down to the Uwajamayas or down to the International District. And walking from here, there's really a lot of cement. A rare blade of grass. And any dirt I see is littered with glass. And I feel cut off from the earth. Of course, everything is a manifestation of the earth. Cement and cars and roads are also a manifestation, of course. But there is a really direct connection, you know, that we feel when we walk on the soil, when we put our hands in the ground, in the earth. I know I always look so much forward to springtime and the first plantings. And at Mountain Lamp, Tracy's have planted the garlic already, and we've got onions and spinach struggling to... shivering. But there's that sense of renewal to be able to put our hands in the earth and to be able to walk on the earth. Because I think we remember something that is true of ourselves, and that is that we are of the earth and we're not separate from the earth. Never. Ever. Whether we're in this current manifestation or all the many potential manifestations of who we are. who we may become. The earth always holds us. And nurtures us and protects us. And when we are most troubled, or wounded, we can lie on the earth, and the earth will embrace us. Any animal that is wounded goes and lies on the earth and stops and is quiet. And when the weather is really inclement and it's cold and there's rain or snow, you find soft places on the earth where the deer have gone and lay, and holes in the earth where the coyotes have dug a hole to den up and be protected by the earth. And we can touch that in our own lives and in our own practice. And it's important to touch that. It's important to touch our connection with the earth. It is more profound than our mind can understand. But it is something our body knows. And so when we walk and touch this soft brown soil, and we let go of all of our distractions and projects, and let ourselves be held by the earth, we find that we are much bigger than we thought, and much safer than we could imagine. That each step is a refuge. That each breath is a refuge. And it's important that we practice like that every week. That we remember that we are inseparable from the earth. And in being inseparable from the earth, we are also inseparable from each other. That we are one body. I remember in one of the early times when I was at Plum Village, Tai had tea with a few of us, and he was asking about our sanghas at home. And at that point, I was living in a little cabin that I'd built in the woods. I was working as a biologist, and I didn't have a sangha of people nearby. The nearest sangha that I knew was 1,000 miles away. And when I got off work, I'd go there to be with my community. And of course, I had lots of friends around me too. But a community of practice was a long way away from me. But so when Tai looked at me and said, "What about your sangha?" I thought about, where do I take refuge on a daily basis? And out in front of the cabin was a small pond, and in the springtime, wood ducks would come to mate and build nests in the trees around the pond. I don't know if you've ever seen a wood duck, but they are extremely gorgeous. They look like they have been hand-painted by the most beautiful artist you can imagine. And they're very shy. don't like to be seen. And so in the morning, when the wood ducks were on the pond, I'd have to get up very carefully and move about the cabin really carefully, or even the little bit of movement would startle them, and they'd leave the pond. So I would get up in the morning knowing that the wood ducks were in the pond and how special it was to be able to see the wood ducks. I'd get up very carefully, very mindfully, and I'd move about the cabin preparing breakfast very, very mindfully, with a lot of stillness inside, so that I wouldn't disturb the wood ducks and I could see them. And I really felt the wood ducks were my sangha, so I told Tai that story. And he liked it. That was a good enough sangha. Joy having a sangha of people close by all the time. It really helps me a lot to take refuge in my sangha. And there have been times in my life, as I know it's true with all of us, where we face huge difficulties, big losses, of a parent, illness, and where our lives seem turned upside down, and how wonderful it is in those times to be able to come to our community and be held by the community in stillness, in protection, in support, just like the earth holds us. And sometimes we don't even have to say anything about what's going on, but we know that our community is there for us. I mentioned that there are lots and lots of sanghas all around the whole world, but also many in the United States, in North America. And over the last almost 5 years now, there's been a small group of us Dharma teachers, both lay and monastic, who have been meeting, having monthly phone conferences and meeting face-to-face once a year. And we started meeting because we'd heard from a lot of sanghas about a lot of difficulties in many sanghas, people not feeling supported, whole communities not feeling supported and in their practice, and there was a sense of there's the order of interbeing, Thai's community, and sometimes it was being referred to as the disorder, and so we're meeting to talk about that, how some of the problems that were in our big community, in our North American community, that were coming up, how they could be looked at and held and changed. Knowing that right now, you know, we have we're so fortunate to have Tai as a focal point, as a person we can all turn to, but that we won't have him forever. He's 84 years old now, could be 85 this year. And that if, as this very large community of that we're part of, is to continue as a very large community, we need to find a way to continue on as his continuation. And it really is Tai's vision that the next Buddha, Maitreya Buddha, the next Buddha to be born will be a community, will be the community of practice. And so we took that up as our mission, is how do we support, sustain, and nourish the community so that it will manifest after Tai ceases to manifest in his current form. How we can manifest as him. And so there were 13 of us representing the fourfold sangha, lay and monastic community. And the first thing we needed to do was to have the support of the community to be doing what we were doing. And the first, when it was kind of got known that we were meeting, it was sort of like, well, what authority do you have, and who are you to be trying to organize things? And so we realized we needed to call a meeting of all the teachers in our tradition and talk with them and get their support and their to continue what we were doing. And so we, 3 years ago, we met as a small community, the council, and talked about, you know, what needed to be looked at, what needed to be taken care of, what needed to be considered, and how to move forward, and then organized a meeting of the larger sangha, and got their blessings to keep going. In this process have been in communication with Tai. There's been efforts at this through the 90s, and they were not made in a harmonious way. It was made generally through some people trying to have power over making it be their way instead of having it be the voice of the Sangha. And so the support from Tai has never been there before. So we knew that we had to be able to move in a way that expressed harmony among everybody involved. And which meant we needed to be completely harmonious ourselves and also completely open to everybody's input, everybody's voice being heard. It's not the way, you know, any of us have learned to do organization. what we are trying to do is create an organism, not an organization, but something that is alive at each moment, that can change and move and be flexible and express the voice of everyone here, all of us. Because we all, to truly be Maitreya on this earth, need to move together as one body. And we do, each and every one of us, I know everyone in this room has the same seed of bodhicitta, that when we dedicate the merit, we are dedicating the merit for peace in the world, peace in our own hearts, peace among the people we love, peace in the midst of difficult situations, peace with difficult people, peace with those who are disenfranchised. And we have to do it as one body. We have to move together as one community. And from that seed that Tai planted in this country in 1966, this is what has grown. So there have been many times in my practice where I have heard Tai speak about, you know, the words that we say all the time in reading the sutras, and I vow to offer joy to one person in the morning and ease the pain of one person in the afternoon, and it all just seems too big and impossible. And I've come to the place of, it doesn't matter if it's too big or impossible. That's totally immaterial. There is only one way for us to move as humanity, as part of the earth. And it doesn't matter what comes from it. There's still only one thing we can do. And that level of faith is unshakable. It doesn't matter what comes out of what we do. It only matters that we do it. It doesn't matter what happens 10 steps from now. It only matters that this step we take in mindfulness, in love, and in peace. And that is the foundation of our practice. And it is also what the earth gives. The earth gives herself freely in every moment, with no expectation of anything coming back. The rivers flow freely. We put a seed in the earth, and a carrot feeds us. The trees are always breathing us. We don't have to ask for any of this. It's always freely given. And nothing is asked in return. And that is the teachings of the earth, and we are of the earth. And we only need to align ourselves with that reality and we will know the great joy and blessedness of the earth as our own joy and blessedness. So when we come together on Monday nights We truly come together as one body. I always love being here because the Sangha is so harmonious. There is so much love and true caring in this community. And it's more than just, you know, us being together on Monday nights, because I see over and over again when someone is in difficulty, someone in the Sangha immediately steps forward. And I can count so many examples over and over and over again over the years. When we've been, the last meeting the Dharma Teachers Council had was not too long ago in March down at Deer Park. And it was, as always, a really wonderful meeting. We really are a community. And there's always so much joy in being together. And we look so much forward to the phone calls and hearing each other's voices. So much support and love there. And everybody is totally unique and different. And everyone is teaching in a totally different way. And every sangha they're involved with is manifesting in a totally different way. One of the sanghas is very much engaged in political, I don't want to say political action, but for instance, before the election, they were going out registering people. And another sangha is supporting a project in Vietnam, digging wells. And as I was hearing people talk about what their sanghas were doing, and I was thinking about, you know, our sangha, and our sangha so much has been about taking care of people in a very immediate way when they're suffering. And I think that's so much an expression of our bodhicitta. To be a bodhisattva means that whenever there is suffering, we don't turn our backs. Wherever there's suffering, we'll be right there. And whether it's in our own hearts and minds, or whether it's in our community, or whether it's walking down the street and meeting a homeless person. And I've seen that spirit, you know, manifest over and over again through so many people in the Sangha, through so many situations. And I feel that, you know, the true expression of a bodhisattva is really alive here. And I take refuge in that. I take refuge in you. And because we have been such a strong and harmonious community, I think we can all take heart and know we do have refuge here with each other. Sort of say all sorts of things bragging about this community.
Thank you.
So every week we have a practice that we take home with us so that we continue to manifest as Maitreya in our lives, as the Bodhisattva Maitreya. Not alone and separate, but with the support and protection of each other. And I would like to suggest that this week, in spite of how bitterly cold it is, we do take refuge in nature at some point. That we walk touching the brown earth as the brown earth. When I drive down here, you know that the road is always different. Every time I drive down here, the road is different. And through the winter, there were so many swans along the route. There were hundreds of swans. And today when I drove down, they're all gone. They've all migrated. But there are now thousands of those beautiful yellow skunk cabbages, which, in spite of their name, were most exquisite plant. And the daffodils, you know, just lining the pathway here. So to take refuge in the beauty of this world, and in it to take refuge in your own beauty, your own Buddha nature, as the earth has manifest you as unique, special, beloved. That the earth has manifested you and continued to support you in this manifestation means the earth must love you. And to realize that and touch that in our practice this week.